Let's get into today's news from KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In the last 15 years, Bellevue High School has won the state football championship 11 times. And according to an independent investigation, the Wolverines have not been playing fair. Investigators commissioned by the Bellevue School District found that football players gave false addresses so they could attend Bellevue High. It also says coaches told players to attend a private school, a school that one player described as a daycare for athletes, and it found that boosters paid thousands of dollars to the team's head coach, Butch Goncharoff. Former federal prosecutor Carl Blackstone co-authored this report, and he told me about the findings.
Let me start at the beginning. When we began this investigation, we did not have subpoena power. We expected to get full cooperation from the Bellevue School District, the Bellevue High School, and the Booster Club. We did not get that. We assumed that all these entities would believe in full and complete transparency. They did not. One of the issues we are exploring is whether the coaches got paid in violation of the WIA regulation. And we determined that there were about a little over $300,000 in payments to coaches during a time in which those payments should have been approved by the school board, which they weren't. We reached out to the Booster Club and said, we see there are these payments. Please provide us with all financial records that prove these payments were legitimate. They refused to give us any records. We asked to talk to Mr. Connors, the president of the Booster Club, to discuss the payment to coaches. He refused to meet with us. We asked Butch Goncharoff during an interview about whether he'd been paid, and he refused to answer those questions.
That's the head coach.
The head coach. And so our report concludes that the Booster Club made payments to the coaches, which were not permitted and had not been disclosed to the school board. Yesterday was the first time we ever heard that they now claim they did make payments to Mr. Goncharoff. They claim it was $60,000 a year, and they claimed it was not for coaching high school football. It would have been nice for them to have told us this before the investigation began. We can think of no reason why they would have withheld this information from us.
You also found that players used false addresses, but the Booster Club says it's not a coach's job to monitor where a player lives. True?
I don't know if that's true or not. What I know is true, Bill, is over the course of 7 years, we identified at least 42 players who transferred to Bellevue High School. And given those circumstances, we would have expected that the coaches and the school district would have been very vigilant to determine those kids were actually living in the district. And what we found was there was a very hands-off approach to determining residency for these football players. In fact, one of the Bellevue school administrators was told not to check addresses because it was a waste of time. So we would think the coaches would be on the first line when they see kids coming to Bellevue from Auburn, from Federal Way, from Sumner. You would think at the very least the coach who is bound by the WIA regulations as much as the school district is would have had some questions about, are these kids really living in the district? And what our evidence, what we found was the coaches didn't do anything.
Then there's this private school in a Bellevue office park. It's been tarnished as a diploma mill, and you found that coaches directed players to go to this less academically rigorous school, and that allows them to go to school in one place and play high school football at Bellevue High. The boosters say, again, telling students about a school they could go to is not against the rules.
Telling students what school to go to is probably not against the rules, but sending students to a school where you know they will get grades and will keep them academically eligible is not permitted. And we gave one example there where Butch Goncharoff, the coach, wanted the player to go to the academic institute for summer school. He had four Fs at Bellevue, which would have made him ineligible to play football. He went to the academic institute and retook those same four classes, and he received three Bs and an A. That speaks for itself. Additionally, we found that the Booster Club was paying tuition for these football players. We have identified at least seven players who we believe either received free tuition or got a significant discount in the tuition. And I think the Booster Club has denied paying the tuition. Again, let me go back to the transparency theme. It wasn't until our investigation began that the Booster Club even admitted that they paid money to the AI. We now know they paid AI. They admitted to paying AI at least $35,000. They never disclosed that to the school district. They did not report those donations on their tax returns. The first time they reported a donation to AI in their tax returns was after we began this investigation and after they knew we knew about the donations. So there's no doubt the Booster Club did pay money to the academic institute. And in our report, we identified an email from the president, the head of the academic institute, to a father of a player who was attending the academic institute. And she says in that email, it's in our report, you need to get the booster club to pay your tuition. We also identified an incident in which the vice president of the booster club, Joe Brazzori, called up a father of a student and said, how much can you afford to pay towards the tuition at the academic institute? The tuition cost $1,750 a month. The father said, all I can pay is $150, and that's all he had to pay. So I think there's plenty of evidence that the booster club was paying tuition for these players. And again, transparency. Why didn't they just go to the Bellevue School District and say, yes, we are giving money to the academic institute, and it's for this reason?
Carl, why would Bellevue High School put their football program at risk with alleged rule violations over and over and over and over again?
That's a question I can't answer, Bill. I mean, Bellevue High School is probably in the best position to answer that, and the booster club's in the best position to answer it. But what we were most shocked about was this is a public institution funded by taxpayer dollar, and we were amazed by the lack of willingness to investigate these things internally, to deal with. They had many years to deal with this. It wasn't as though this is a surprise to the superintendent or other high-level administrators. In our report, we found there was willful blindness and deliberate ignorance. They did not do what they should have done. And then when we came in to do the first independent, no one's ever done an independent investigation of this program. And when we came in, they resisted our efforts. They did not cooperate with us. And we were just shocked to see that behavior from a public entity. I don't think that's appropriate. We've done a lot of work for the Seattle schools, the Tacoma schools, and for Governor Inslee. And in all those cases, we've got nothing but complete and utter cooperation. Any document we want, anybody we want to talk to, the Bellevue School District did not act accordingly.
Okay, that's Carl Blackstone, a former federal prosecutor whose independent investigation found that Bellevue High School's football program has been violating state rules for years. The Bellevue Wolverines Booster Club says it has not broken any rules, and there's no evidence to prove they have. I asked the Booster Club's president, John Connors, why he thinks investigators would falsely accuse them.
Yeah, you know, I can't get in the minds of what their motives are. All I know is that the conduct of the investigation and then the report they produced, both were severely flawed. It's just astounding that these guys would include so many inaccurate and misleading statements. They relied on a host of anonymous sources and independent sources and unnamed witnesses that nobody has any idea what they're saying or why. And then their defense of their practices and tactics of the investigation was really, really surprising. But we're very confident we'll be vindicated on the facts, and we really look forward to working with the district on getting those cleared up.
The investigator, Carl Blackstone, says they could have been a lot more specific if you'd cooperated. Why didn't you meet with them, turn over records?
We agreed to meet with them right from the outset based on what the district had asked. Immediately when they started the investigation, they began this process of looking at a whole host of issues that had nothing to do with what the district asked to be investigated. Further, their early investigation tactics with those people at the district, the coaches, made it clear that there was no way we were going to sit down with these guys and be subjected to the kind of prosecutorial abuse that they were exercising.
Well, they were told to look into payments to the head coach, and they say they're just now finding out about $60,000 a year in payments that you say are legitimate, but why didn't you just turn over the records they asked for?
Here's the exact reason for that, Bill, is we complied with every single question the district asked us to answer, and the district and the WIA agreed on what the scope was. We made very clear on every single item exactly what we've done, how we've done it. There is not a single violation in any of these accusations, and we're very, very comfortable that when the district and KINCO go through these supposed violations and how we've done things, that we'll be vindicated.
John, even if you are going to be vindicated, and all of this is within the rules, this system of players transferring in, going to a private school in an office park with lower academic standards and playing at Bellevue High and having false addresses, even if it wasn't the coach's job to check that, in a district with funders who can augment the coach's salary, even if those payments are in the rules, does this system of high school sports and academics seem right to you and fair?
You know, I think it's extraordinarily right and extraordinarily fair. And what hasn't been fair is the depiction of the community in the program. It's no secret that kids would want to come to a successful program. The notion that somehow the district, the coaches, and the booster club would collaborate to jam kids into a substandard school so they could play football is outrageous. We've been very clear in all the contributions we've made, whether it's Academic Institute, whether it's the money we've given to cheer, to band, to drill, to track and field. It's actually a story that is completely at odds with this report, and we feel really comfortable we'll be vindicated.
This investigator, Carl Blackstone, says that payments made to the coach should have been approved by the school district, and the school district wasn't informed and didn't approve the payments. Is that true?
Mr. Blackstone and Mr. Westinghouse absolutely do not understand the rules under the WIAA. Coaches can't be paid in season. That's the rule. We're very familiar with it because we've had an investigation in the past. Outside of a season, coaches can be paid for a host of things.
Without informing the school district and without approval from the school district?
Without approving the school district. Our club isn't a booster club for football only. We don't have to go to the school board to get approval to have Butch help us get Franklin football off the ground.
So the head coach does a lot of things out of season beyond just coach the football team that you gave him payments for.
Butch is a community treasure that has helped thousands of young men in this community. I know personally from the incredible impact the man has had on my three sons. He's being unfairly maligned, and it's a tragedy. And the notion that these guys would be somehow not doing their job is an outrage. More importantly, Bill, we've got to make sure that this type of investigation never happens again to any school, to any kids, to any families, and that the WIA gets control of how they allow an investigation like this to happen. And when people see all the errors, the misstatements, the intentional smearing that was done in these reports, they are going to be appalled, and that will come out. I never really understood and didn't have a good idea of the people in America that feel like there's prosecutorial abuse and they don't have a voice. Now I get it, but we're going to fight back, and we look forward to, first of all, vindicating Butch, vindicating our coaches, protecting our kids, and then finally removing the stigma from our district that somehow our district would participate in this hallucinatory story.
That is John Connors, head of the Bellevue Wolverines Booster Club. We also heard from independent investigator Carl Blackstone. Next, his findings will go to the King County League. The Kinko League is going to decide on any sanctions. Bellevue's football program could be put on probation, could have their 11 state titles taken away. We'll follow the story for you. This is KUOW's The Record. On The Record, I'm Bill Radke, talking more about accusations now. A federal jury in Tacoma has found Washington State's auditor, Troy Kelly, not guilty on one charge of lying to the IRS. The jury deadlocked yesterday on the remaining 14 counts, including possession of stolen funds, money laundering, and filing false tax returns. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins has been covering the trial.
Kelly stared straight ahead and showed no emotion as Judge Ronald Layton read the jury's findings. On possession of stolen property, no verdict. Making false statements, no verdict. Money laundering, no verdict. And then finally, one not guilty finding on a charge of making a false statement to IRS investigators in 2013. Afterwards, Kelly shook hands with his defense team and hugged and kissed his wife. Outside the courtroom, defense attorney Angelo Calfo declared victory.
Well, we're pleased with the verdict. We think it was the right outcome.
Calfo said the hung jury proved the point he'd made at closing arguments, that the feds never should have brought this case against Kelly in the first place.
So what we're hopeful now is that the government's prepared to acknowledge this is a case they shouldn't have brought and dismiss the charges so that Troy can move on with his life.
You think that'll happen?
I'm confident that they'll make the right decision.
In a statement, U.S. Attorney Annette Hayes in Seattle thanked the jury and the prosecutors and said her office will thoroughly review the counts that the jury deadlocked on before making a decision about next steps. Even before the verdict was announced, it was clear jurors were deadlocked. The jury telegraphed its struggles in notes to the judge. Eventually, Judge Layton brought them back into the jury room and polled the jurors to see if they thought they could work through their impasse. Most said no, a few said yes. A short while later, they sent another note back saying they were still deadlocked. Mike Lowy was the jury foreman. The postman and wrestling coach from Roy, Washington, described deliberations that were heated at times.
There were certain people that get it set in their mind that he just wasn't guilty. So, and then if some one person thought it was guilty, then we couldn't, you know, come to a unanimous decision.
Lowy said personally he felt some of Kelly's actions were questionable, but ultimately he said he and most of the jurors could not convict on the marquee charge, possession or concealment of stolen funds.
The whole stolen money was really hard for us. It was hard to establish that it was actually stolen. We were split to that, so that's how it was.
Kelly was accused of pocketing millions of dollars in homeowner fees that should have been refunded. This was when he ran a real estate services document tracking business during the pre-recession housing bubble before he was elected state auditor. He was also accused of trying to conceal the money through a series of bank transfers and seeking to avoid paying taxes on it. Kelly's attorneys maintained that he was entitled to keep the funds and had a legally defensible plan to pay taxes on the money over a 10-year period. Lowy, the jury foreman, said those starkly different theories of the case made the job of deciding the case harder, but he also acknowledged some frustration at deadlocking.
Personally, it is a little dissatisfying, but talking with the judge afterwards was really cool because he said, you know, this is the judicial system at work, and when you have that many different people trying to decide on something that is so, not vague, but, you know, being presented in both sides, it is kind of hard to do. So
Kelly left the courthouse with his wife and supporters without speaking to the media. His attorney says as long as there's the potential for a retrial, Kelly won't be making any public comments about the case. But Calfo said his client was feeling relieved and said Kelly is on a path to vindication. Kelly has said he does not plan to run for re-election this year. He's ignored repeated calls to resign ever since he was indicted last April. In a statement, Governor Jay Inslee said serious questions remain about Kelly's ability to successfully fulfill his role as state auditor. I'm Austin Jenkins in Tacoma.
The governor of Washington questioning the legitimacy of the state auditor who remains in office. We will see what happens next. Again, the man in charge of policing state corruption, Troy Kelly, found guilty of none of the charges against him. Coming up on the record, a Seattle researcher is working on a way to prevent sudden infant death syndrome. We'll have that report in 20 minutes on KUOW Seattle. Thanks for joining us on KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Now that recreational pot use is legal in Oregon, people with marijuana convictions on their records are taking advantage of another new law, one that makes it easier to get those felonies erased. KUOW's Salem correspondent Chris Lehman visited a former felon who says he feels like a new man.
When I met him last year, Tim McClure was living with the shame of being a felon.
I don't think it's the measure of me as a man.
When McClure was 42 years old, he was convicted of illegally growing marijuana on his ranch near The Dalles, Oregon. He says it was supposed to be a small grow for some medical marijuana patients, but ended up being a little larger than planned. He pled guilty and was fined, but never served any time behind bars. In the years since then, he stayed out of trouble with the law. But his business failed, his marriage fell apart, and some of his friends never spoke to him again. McClure told me back then the conviction was a weight he just couldn't shake off.
I'm an unlikely convicted felon, I think. And I think after 15 years, there ought to be some remedy available to me.
It turns out, after 16 years, there was.
I had tears of joy. You know, it still brings tears to my eyes thinking about it.
McClure's referring to the day this spring when he opened his mail to see a letter from his attorney. His application to have his felony marijuana conviction expunged had been approved.
It's a watershed moment for me.
The expungement means McClure can now legally say he's never been convicted of a crime. His criminal record has been sealed. To test out his new freedom, McClure went to a gun store and tried to buy a gun, something you can't do if you're a felon.
I stood there on pins and needles, you know, wondering if they're going to call out over the loudspeaker, you know, that I failed my background check. I finally eventually left the store because I was too nervous.
It took almost 2 hours, but eventually the call came. He owned a new handgun. So how did McClure go from a down-on-his-luck felon to an ex-con with no criminal record? He did it thanks to a law passed by the 2015 Oregon legislature. It allows people with marijuana-related felonies to get their slates wiped clean if the crimes they were convicted of are no longer illegal. Portland attorney Sandy Pelican handled McClure's case.
The correct legal terminology is to set aside. You set aside the record of the conviction and seal the arrest.
Pelican says people who want their records expunged can't have had any other criminal convictions in the past 10 years. The process had already been available to people with lesser marijuana offenses. But the new law opens the doors to potentially thousands more people. State officials say the number who've applied so far is much lower than that. Pelican says clients who've successfully had their marijuana felonies sealed tell her they've had an easier time getting a job, getting an apartment.
Or, I'm able to travel to Canada. That's another big one.
Back in Wasco County, Tim McClure hops on his ATV to scan for predators eyeing his cattle. The handgun he bought isn't the tool he needs, though.
I am going to have a varmint gun, something that I can, you know, reach out and get a coyote if it's close to the house.
McClure says he never met Pelican, his attorney, but he says if he did, he'd go up and give her a hug. At 58 years old, he says, the expungement has given him a new lease on life.
I'm not going to be defined by the 16 years that I was a felon. I want to be defined by who I was before the felony and what I am and what I will become after the felony.
And in case you're curious, it cost McClure about $1,000 in application fees and legal bills to get his record sealed. He says it was the best $1,000 he ever spent. I'm Chris Lehman in The Dalles, Oregon.
Oregon and Washington still working out this transition to a world where recreational marijuana use is no longer illegal. Not on the state level, anyway. Coming up on KUOW's The Record, when should a professor be allowed to date a student? We'll take a look in 20 minutes. It's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. I'm going to tell you a story now of mystery and secrecy. It's about the location of a mythological place called Tanis. It might be right here in the Northwest. Terry Miles is executive producer of Tanis, the podcast, and he told me the whole story. This guy, Nick Silver, encounters two references to Tanis, the place. One in a short story, one in a radio program.
Nick discovered the short story, Where's Tanis, in Strange Worlds magazine, the first and only edition of that magazine in San Francisco when he was much younger. And that combined with the radio, public radio program called Pacific Northwest Stories that Nick used to work at, did an episode that was myth-based, Atlantis, Bigfoot, Bermuda Triangle. And in that episode, there was an unused section by Professor Adams that referenced Tanis, and he put those two things together and decided to look into this potentially real-world mystery.
So it's very important to Nick, and by Nick I might mean you, the pursuit of not just of this mystery, but the pursuit of mystery. Why is that important?
Yeah, no, there's I feel like I miss mystery. I miss that sense of not knowing, of discovery, of, you know, picking up a book based on the cover. Of course, I'm not going to judge it by the cover, but it might be nice to, just sort of discover something without knowing everything there is to know about it by Googling it in advance, you know? And I just, that was the sort of, you know, that was the kind of what if that started me down the path to Tanis. Like, what if there was this myth that, you couldn't find on the internet. There's nothing about it. And what if when you started looking, you started uncovering all kinds of other sort of connective tissue that kept leading back to this central myth? And that excitement in discovering a sense of mystery was, I mean, it was the sort of, it was everything to, you know, it was the thing that led me to Tanis.
Okay, so once we are launched on this mystery, what kind of weirdnesses ensue?
Well, yeah, as soon as Nick starts peeling back the layers of Tanis and finding these strange connections and interesting paths, it opens up pretty much globally and along a deep historical timeline. You know, Jack the Ripper enters the story, perhaps, Charles Manson. You know, there are rock star suicides that are referenced. There's a mysterious town called Raywood, Washington, where the town has just been completely abandoned. There's a mundane reason for this, and there's also perhaps another reason for this. And you know, through all of this, there's a deep conspiracy that might be operating behind the scenes, keeping everything off of the internet and keeping sort of Nick on his toes. And there's also the cult of Tanis, a group of like a Knights Templar kind of organization that communicated through classified ads in the 50s, and just like a whole web of weird internet mysteries connected to Tanis as well. Reddit A858. There's a character in the show named Mir Catnip, who is a information specialist. She's basically a hacker, and she helps Nick navigate these kind of more arcane internet mysteries.
So what role does the setting of the Pacific Northwest play in the way the mystery unfolds?
Well, I think the setting is the key. I mean, there's just something about the kind of deep emerald gloom of the Pacific Northwest that seeps into everything Tanis. I mean, it's central to the whole thing, and it's something that inspired me and took a while to sort of seep into my bones, I think. Moving from the middle of Canada in Montana-ish area, Alberta, and moved to Vancouver to play music back in the 90s, and Seattle as well. But at that point, it felt like, you know, the fresh sort of green wonder of the coast. But years later, it started to change. I think it probably has a lot to do with the rain and the overcast skies. But, you know, 5-6 years later, it started to feel different, and it started to seep into all of my writing and all of my the music and everything at that time. And so Tanis is essentially all of the geography of the Pacific Northwest is Tanis, I think. I mean, and you know, culturally, it all of that darkness and rain and gloom, you know, so it's not just the sort of the physical manifestation of the deep emerald gloom, but it's also the sort of cultural. I mean, all of that affects the people and it starts to inform everything.
You said something there about it's fictional. No, it's mysterious. And I'm wondering, what's the relationship to truth in this story? And do your listeners have the same understanding you do?
Well, the nature of truth is it's an elusive thing. I think for when it comes to Tanis, there are so many real world elements, like let's say Jack Parsons or L. Ron Hubbard or Charles Manson, but there are also fictional accounts of certain things, Atlantis being one, the Bermuda Triangle being another, characters who may or may not have existed, and the, like, I may have referenced a fictional town, but is it fictional? Is it real? It's kind of, there's a line where it becomes more of what you believe is true rather than what is true. And the audience have different levels of understanding of truth when it comes to Tanis. There are some people who consider 100% of everything that happens on Tanis true, and then there are others who feel it's a lot closer to fiction. I'm not sure what the balance is exactly numerically, but I think you find your own sort of understanding of what's true and what's not.
Are you trying to fool your listeners?
Well, there's don't you miss mystery? I mean, I just feel like there's a lack of mystery in the world, and it's isn't it a much richer place if something like Tanis could be true?
So a world with mystery in it is truer than a world of black and white, because that's not the way the world is. Is that what you're saying?
That's my hope. Yeah, I really feel like if something like Tanis could be real, just if it could be real, not whether it is or not, I think that that's a much more interesting world than one where, you know, we know everything in advance. And we certainly don't know everything when it comes to science and dark matter. And, you know, there could be so many things happening out there. And I don't want to be Pollyanna about I just really miss mystery. And it's Tanis is my attempt to inject a little mystery into the world.
So where is Tanis?
Well, Tanis is located somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, right around the Puget Sound area, generally.
That's all you're going to get right now from Terry Miles, executive producer of the popular podcast, Tanis. If you want to keep working at it and figuring out where Tanis is, we're tweeting out a link to the podcast at KUOW. Now, back in the real world, little news update here. The CEO of the Seattle Mariners is reportedly stepping down. Seattle Times says there's a 3:00 news conference scheduled today where Howard Lincoln will say he's leaving the ball club after being the Mariners CEO for 16 years. The Mariners are now leading the American League West by half a game. They're 11-9, but that's a lead, and this is the record. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. Sudden Infant Death Syndrome, or SIDS, is a mystery. It causes more than 2,000 babies to die in their sleep each year in the United States, and we still don't know how or why SIDS happens. Dr. Daniel Rubens of Seattle Children's Hospital might have figured it out. He thinks inner ear damage in babies might prevent them from getting body signals that tell them to move when their breathing gets difficult during sleep. There are preliminary animal trials that support his theory.
We look at these animals, and what we found is that the animal with the inner ear dysfunction to that moderate degree, they don't make the movement arousal responses, meaning they don't pick their head up and move away from the original position which was creating the problem to access fresh air, take the breaths that they need, and survive.
Starting next month, Dr. Rubens will begin a new study that could lead to development of a simple screening to find infants who are at risk of SIDS.
We're looking for a way to look at the newborn hearing screen test and the possibility of using that test to identify babies at risk for SIDS. At this point, the newborn hearing screening, it's not ready to detect the babies at risk, but we're wanting to do that research to look at that comprehensively to see if we actually can do that.
The study will run for 2 years, but it's already giving hope to grieving parents who are looking for some kind of closure. Aileen Carroll lost her daughter to SIDS 14 years ago. Lucy Marie Carroll was 3.5 months old. It was her first day at daycare. Carroll told KUOW's Kim Malcolm that in the months after her daughter's death, she agonized over what she could have done differently.
You keep playing that tape over. I remember, you know, my mantra would constantly be playing that role. What if, coulda, shoulda, woulda? What if I wouldn't have taken her that day? What if we would have just kept her at home? What if I'd been more vigilant about saying she sleeps on her back only? Would she still be alive today? So I'm sure I was going a little nutty because I was thinking, well, what if she really wasn't dead? Maybe it was like a fake sleep or something, or maybe it's got to be wrong. This has to be wrong. This can't really be happening. I mean, a nightmare, literally, that you just cycle through and you can't deal with. And we had a little, you know, little boy at home. And honestly, if it wasn't for him, I might not be here. I was really dark. And not a lot of conversation with my husband. I mean, as equally as unconsoled as I was, so was he, but we couldn't really console each other. We both knew how bad it was. Just crying and just trying to get out of bed every day was Herculean effort. But a lot of just questioning why and trying to figure it out, and it made no sense. There was no answer to it.
And what impact did that have on your grieving process?
You know, it's funny. In retrospect, I think it was just sort of a spin. Like, there was no, I couldn't, she was a completely healthy baby for all intents and purposes. She'd had one little ear infection and otherwise completely healthy. At 3.5 months old, really alert, paying attention, loved her older brother, could hear his voice, knew instantly, could hear, smell, you know, was just really an engaged, alert, healthy baby. So trying to say, well, she just turned off, like trying to explain it to my, you know, my 3-year-old, who was trying to understand where is she and why isn't she coming home and what happened? Why did her heart stop beating? And we said, because she just sort of, she went to sleep and her body just turned off.
So she was gone, mm-hmm. and time went by. Mm-hmm. What kind of impact did her loss end up having on your family?
It changed everything. What you built together and the hope that you have in this out-of-order death sequence really throws you into a tailspin about, well, what did I think? What do I believe? Who am I? What is this all about? You start questioning everything. Immediately, both my husband and I were not at work, but he had a sales job. It wasn't really inspiring for him. I was working for Starbucks Coffee Company. So we made the decision, as much as I didn't want to, I went back to work. And then he ended up staying at home with our son. We said, no more daycare. We just couldn't be back there and sort of stopped trusting a daycare. No one else was going to be able to care for our children as well as us. And then we had another child afterward. He came along about 18 months later. So we'd done research on, well, what do you do? What if you ever have another baby? And we were panicky. We're like, oh, this is a beautiful thing, but we're very concerned. So we did all the research about what is a safe sleep environment, and we were vigilant about that to the T. No bed sharing. He slept on his back in a room that was, I had a temperature control on the bed. No crib bumpers, no fuzzy stuff in the bed. We didn't need alarms. They were like all the things. We went with evidence-based information.
Were you able to sleep at night?
Not terribly well. And we'd find ourselves, even in a nap, I might sit in the room, poke at him a little bit. I'd sleep next to the crib. You know, if they're sleeping, I'd put my hand up, my fingers into the crib, breathing. Constantly checking, breathing, watching for the chest to move up and down. I still do it with them.
They're teenagers.
They're teenagers, or my 3-year-old. I have 3 boys, 3 surviving boys.
And you're still doing it.
And if I don't think they're, you know, boy, they're sleeping a long time, I'll still go in and I check.
You're now working with other families who have also lost a child to sudden
yes.
infant death syndrome. What do you tell them to help them from your experience?
They're going to make it. You can survive this. And you can come out of this and still have hope and still have love. You will never forget your baby. A lot of people worry you're going to forget this baby. And I said, you'll never forget this baby because your baby really existed. And that there's hope, that there is there's hope for an answer at some point. We are going to figure this out, and one day we're going to crack the code on this, and it'll be a great day because they don't have to continue to spin with the why, the why, the why. It takes a lot of courage to keep moving forward, and I often say that it's my personal mantra is to have courage and hope all the time, because it's devastating. I wish it never happened, but it did. So I can do something good as a result of it. If we can't, I mean, we have to learn how to do good from tragedy and get good from tragedy. At least that's what I think.
Aileen Carroll lost her infant daughter to sudden infant death syndrome 14 years ago. She told KUOW's Kim Malcolm about it last year. We also talked with Dr. Daniel Rubens of Seattle Children's Hospital. He's starting a new study in May to try to develop a screening to find infants who are at risk of SIDS. This is KUOW's The Record. Here with KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. The University of Washington allows professors to date students if there's no conflict of interest. They can't date a student who's currently in their classroom. That's about the policy in most North American colleges. But the University of British Columbia is considering a ban on all professor-student romantic relationships. The school's president says this might be the first ban of its kind in Canada. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, good to talk with you, Vaughn.
Hi, Bill. This is a really interesting one because the University of British Columbia lately stands accused of having really lagged on this issue, so I guess the president's trying to get ahead of the curve for a change.
Why is the university considering it? What prompted it?
Prompted by some fairly disturbing evidence over the last year or two of the university not responding the way it should to complaints of sexual harassment on campus, to students that had a number of complaints. The Green leader here in British Columbia, Andrew Weaver, who was himself a university professor, he got up in the legislature recently and called for legislation that would require universities to have a comprehensive policy for dealing with complaints of harassment and to keep statistics and records, both of how many complaints they got and how they dealt with them, how they managed them. That prompted the government here in British Columbia, Premier Christy Clark, to say Weaver had a point and say she was going to bring in legislation and require all the universities to have this policy. So that's all the background. Now, the president of UBC, President Piper, just the other day said the university is putting together a policy. It will be out for discussion in June. And one of the things that she wants people on campus to be discussing is what you just referred to, Bill, an outright ban on intimate or romantic relationships between professors and students. She says the power relationship is so inherently unfair to the students that a conflict policy may not be enough. You need an outright ban.
What does the faculty say about this, Vaughn?
Well, there's been two reactions. You know, it's interesting. The UBC, the head of the UBC Faculty Association said this week that the faculty at UBC would welcome such a discussion. The head of Canadian University Faculty Associations, however, said, and you referred to it a little earlier there, that existing conflict of interest policies cover this. That the fact that it's an inherent conflict, most faculty and professors respect it, and if they don't, it's covered by essentially their employment relationship. So the head of the National Association says the legislation isn't needed. The head of the association at British Columbia at UBC says, let's have a discussion. Let's talk about this. We've got to get this out in the open because clearly there is a growing concern about it, so let's talk.
So we have a disagreement over whether the rules right now are actually stopping the kinds of power imbalances, conflict of interest that we want to prevent?
You know, I think when you talk particularly to older faculty at the universities, what they tell you is in their working years, in their lifetimes, they've seen a dramatic change. They all know incidents when they started out teaching where professors would not only become romantically involved with their students, they would end up marrying them. There would be relationships formed quietly on the side. And the conflict policies were originally intended to address that, as were harassment policies. But I think what you're seeing here is a recognition that you need a much better policy. It needs to be codified. And I think the one thing that Weaver, the Green Party leader, has really brought forward is there needs to be a process that's clearly there for every student who has concern and a process for reporting. whether you have to go as far as an outright ban on even consensual relationships, which is what you're talking about with the ban. Obviously, harassment isn't allowed. Obviously, sexual assault is an issue, or any kind of sexual harassment. But whether you need an outright ban on consensual relationships, you know, I think what you said right off the top, Bill, is correct. UBC would be breaking new ground with that. The head of the Faculty Association says it's a debate we can have. I don't know as though they will end up going that far, but I do think you're going to see new and much tougher policies and legislation here in British Columbia.
So then what's going to happen next in this conversation, Vaughn?
We're expecting the provincial legislation any day now. Our legislature is sitting right now, and it will continue to sit through to the end of May. UBC is promising a first draft of their policy will be out in June. British Columbia's other colleges and universities are doing the same. Some of them say they already have policies, and they will simply tighten them up. Others are saying we're going to get new policies. So this is unfolding this year. I think by summertime we'll have a much better sense of what, at least for discussion purposes, is happening. And as I said, I think the legislation will be in place before our provincial legislature rises late May.
We talk every Wednesday about the news from Canada with Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Vaughn, good to talk with you as always.
Bye-bye, Bill. Talk to you next week.
Okay. I was talking with a spokesperson for the University of Washington about this whole question, and as I said, the UW allows professors to date students if there's no conflict of interest. They can't date a student who's in the classroom, and the spokesperson told me that if there's no instructional relationship there, then the school views that as two people meeting, forming a romantic relationship, and following it wherever it leads. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. The big news today is that Carly Fiorina, who ended her presidential bid earlier this year, is tossing her hat back in the ring in another way as a vice presidential hopeful. Apparently, the presidential contender Ted Cruz is choosing Carly Fiorina to serve as his running mate. He's making that announcement even though we're still in the campaign and he's significantly trailing Donald Trump in the bid for the Republican nomination. More news from around the world coming up here on KUOW Seattle.